Man, we got gale force winds blowing in every conceivable context here. Literally, in Florida, and figuratively in the political world. Kamala Harris said something yesterday that should be the end of her campaign. It should signify the end of her campaign. I'll tell you what it is coming up here on the commute with Carlson. And yes, it's our legendary lyric week as well. It's Wednesday, and we'll get into that in a moment. But right now, again, we're talking hurricane. At 7:04, we'll be talking with Cliff Mass, University of Washington, about what he thinks Hurricane Milton's strength will be, its path of destruction, and how bad that destruction will look like. But before we get to the professor literally taking an overhead view of Hurricane Milton, a storm that Governor DeSantis there said could be the worst storm in that state's history, what's it like if you're on the ground? Well, it so happens that Jason Randall, who's lived in Orlando for years, has a business there, also happens to be the nephew of our radio legend Mark Christopher, can join us for a few moments to tell us what it looks like on the ground. Jason Randall, welcome to the John Carlson Show. Good morning. How are you, sir?
Good morning, John. I'm doing fantastic.
Okay. So, how's the weather?
Not so good.
Go ahead.
And we've got the calm before the storm right now.
Yes.
So.
Okay, so take us there right now. Is it rainy? Is it warm? Is it humid? What's it like right now?
No, it's a little bit overcast and drizzly rain, which is usually what happens with these storms as they start to approach the coast.
Okay, so in terms of the hurricane's path, it's still not for certain where it's going. Are you in an area where they've asked people to evacuate, or are you just kind of on the edge there?
No, we're far enough inland that typically we don't evacuate from the Orlando area. Now, they have made mandatory evacuations for people in low-lying areas, the people that are in mobile homes and that kind of deal. But typically, the evacuation areas are on the coast, so that's where that whole thing comes in.
Okay, because a lot of our listeners don't know Florida. You know, they don't know Orlando from Tampa, from Miami, in terms of where they sit on the map and how in danger they are. Right now, where would you say the areas that are most vulnerable to a devastating hit are?
South of Tampa and in the Sarasota area, which is, if you were to look at the map of Florida, it's about halfway down the state, is on the left side of the coast is mm-hmm. Tampa. And then Sarasota is about 30 miles south of that. And then Fort Myers is another 30, 40 miles south of that. So that's kind of where they think that this storm is going to hit, is in that area. And then just basically.
And where are you in proximity to that, Jason? You're up north, right?
We're due east of Tampa, Florida.
Okay, east
of
Florida.
So if you were to just draw a line straight across the state, right across the middle of the state, that's where we are. And so we're 90 miles in from one side of the coast and 90 miles in from the other side of the coast.
John, can I just ask, Jason, this is your uncle here.
Yep.
So you've been there since 96. You've been through many storms. Does this compare to any other hurricane? And are you prepped? Are you like thinking, okay, it might hit? And how unusual is this coming from Tampa Bay rather than usually up the coast, like, let's say, from Miami?
Yeah, this one's a lot different in the sense that normally these larger hurricanes come in from the Atlantic Ocean and then kind of skirt up the coast, or they'll come over the top, you know, over the top of Florida that way. This late in the season, they very rarely ever form in the Gulf of Mexico and come across this way. The thing that's got us a little more worried than in the past is the fact that the intensity of this storm even when it goes over land. Typically, when they hit the land, they will slow down considerably with the winds. This one, they're predicting almost a hurricane 2 force winds in the Orlando area, and then being a hurricane still when it goes off the east coast of Florida, which is not normal. Usually it's down to a tropical storm or even a tropical depression after it gets off the coast.
Well, we are hoping and praying for the best for the people of Florida, particularly you, Jason, and other folks who've had to weather previous storms. You're used to this. Well, you're used to stormy weather. You're used to hurricanes, feeling the effects of tropical storms and hurricanes. But this one could be a really, I mean, this one could be the mother of all storms, they are saying.
That's absolutely. And one of the other things I'd like to bring up is the fact that since COVID, we have a lot of different populations down here now that have never gone through a storm like this. You've got the people that have been here for a long time that just kind of blow these things off. And then you've got the other ones that are just don't have a clue what they're in for. And one of the things I will say, though, is I'm impressed at how many people have evacuated. You know, a lot of times they'll do these mandatory evacuations. However, they cannot force people out of their homes. And some time ago, some of the local sheriffs that said, you know, we understand we can't force you, but if you can make it easier for us to identify you, if that comes to pass, please write down with a Sharpie on your arm your name, Social Security number, and date of birth. So, and because they said that, a lot more people actually heed these warnings. You know, you don't see the hurricane parties like you used to when I first moved down here. You know, people just kind of hanging out on the beach and, you know, watching these things. So,
okay.
Jason, one thing you've always shared, too, when it comes to Orlando, real quick here, the theme parks were built there from Disney because no chance of ever getting a thunderstorm or a kind of a hurricane. Are they closing today? I know it's only been a few times, but what's the status in all the theme parks, Epcot, and, of course, Universal Florida as well?
Yep. All the theme parks are closing today by 1 p.m. They'll reopen when they feel it's safe. So they're talking probably reopening on Friday, depending on how fast the storm moves through. But, yeah, every one of the theme parks is closing at 1 o'clock. The Orlando International Airport closed this morning at 8 a.m. So that they can get all of their stuff buttoned down and then get their employees home so that they can be safe with their families.
Excellent. Excellent. Great report. Thank you very much. I really appreciate it, Jason. Stay safe down there.
Okay. Hey, I appreciate it. And, you know, hopefully on Friday I can have a report of that we came through this thing with flying colors. So.
Yes. If you answer the phone, we will know things are good. All right?
Absolutely. Hey, you guys have a great time up there in the Northwest.
All right. Thank you very much. Yes. This is when you take our overcast, drizzly weather a little bit for granted and you realize, you know, we got it kind of lucky here.
Storms in the past, I usually call Jason to say hi and check in with him. He goes, Mark, you know how they exaggerate? Let me clarify. Yesterday, I called him on my ferry boat ride home. I said, Jason, where are we at? Are we just like overdoing it here up in the Northwest? He goes, oh, no, this baby is serious. And he said, not since 2004 have I been this nervous. So just say a prayer and we'll see what happens.
All right. All right. And we'll have Cliff Mast give us an overview about what he thinks is likely going to happen later today into the wee hours tomorrow. That's when it's expected to hit with maximum force, is later this afternoon into the wee hours after midnight. Okay, with that said, ladies and gentlemen, it is Wednesday. You know what we do? Our legendary lyric contest here on The Commute with Carlson. The way it works is I read you the lyric from a hit song, and you try and place that lyric if you can. And when you hear us actually play it, going in or coming back from a commercial break. You'd be caller number 10, and some nice prizes are awaiting you.
People like the food. People like the reads. And we got them for you this week, John. Daniel's Broiler, Seattle's favorite since 1980. Prime steak, of course, USDA, with that stamp on there, the cocktails. Daniel's Broiler, four locations, Bellevue, downtown Seattle, Leschi, South Lake Union. Yes, they have the party rooms. Online reservations, dine-in, takeout, make a reservation online. I love that. And, of course, think about your holiday party. Have a look. It's a great website, danielsbroiler.com. For the read that we have to add to the collection, John, of course, that new book, Follow the Science, from award-winning investigative news reporter and good friend of KVI, host of ABC's TV's Full Measure, Cheryl Atkinson. Follow the Science, How Big Pharma Misleads, Obscures, and Prevails.
It's one of her best books. Her previous three have been bestsellers. So this one also joining the list. So you get all that. Here is your lyric. It is from a hit song, a hit from the 60s and later again in the 80s. So a two-tiered hit. Here we go. But how many heartaches must I stand before I find a love to let me live again? But how many heartaches must I stand before I find a love to let me live again? When you hear it, I guarantee you go, oh, yes, for heaven's sakes. Who could forget that one? And I'm going to give another hint.
Then I have a question after that. Go ahead.
How often do I do a double hint? Huh?
All right, go ahead. Yep.
One of the hits was from an American artist. The second time was from an artist overseas.
Ooh.
Okay?
All right.
So there you have it.
So am I wide open? Do I go for the 60s or the 80s? Or can I choose and make it a mystery? We'll just have to see what happens.
You'll just have to wait.
I'll check with Phil.
All right.
We may have to play with this one. Either one. Okay.
So it looks like so far I have even the radio legend and Philip J. Vandervoort III a little bit stumped on this one. Okay. We have a lot more coming your way on The Commute with Carlson. Kamala Harris has, in my opinion, answered a question. A question she should have been asked months ago, and for some reason has not. She wasn't asked in any of the interviews that she's done. She wasn't asked during the debate. But she was finally asked yesterday on The View by co-host Sonny Hostin. Again, she was received like Taylor Swift at a Swifties convention. I mean, just adulatory. It couldn't have been, you know, a frenzied response. And so her guard was down. And one of the most liberal of the View hosts, Sonny Hostin, asked her this question.
Well, if anything, would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
Once again, she wouldn't change a thing.
We can't afford 4 more years of this.
Thank you, Vice President Waltz. Yes. So we can't afford anything like we've seen for the last 4 years, but Kamala can't think of anything that she would do different. My good buddy Ari Hoffman beat me to the punch. I heard what she said, and I went, oh, man, I've been telling people that this clip by Joe Biden, where Joe Biden says, she and I are very close. We're singing off the same song sheet. Our staffs work closely together. She helped me get legislation passed that otherwise wouldn't have passed. I said, all they have to do is play that over and over again on the Trump campaign's part, and they win. And now you have Sonny Hostin asking Kamala Harris this on The View, and for some reason, she didn't appear to be ready for the question. And she said, I can't think of anything.
Would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
That's all they have to do. Good show, Ari Hoffman. That's all they have to do. Why is that all they have to do? Because less than 30% of the people, less than 30% of the American people think we're on the right track. Two-thirds of the American people think we're on the wrong track. And here you have Kamala, who, by the way, insists that she's the candidate for change and is actually getting some traction on that issue. Americans are evenly divided between Trump and Harris, between Kamala and the Donald, on which candidate represents change, which is just absurd. Kamala is not an old white man, but there's nothing she would have done differently from the old white man. She looks different. She has a much more annoying laugh. She's more sentient. I'll give her that. But there isn't a dime's worth of difference when it comes to policy. If anything, Kamala would be even more liberal. So if they play their cards right, the Trump campaign will play that clip over and over again. And, oh, it is so delicious that the Q&A that should end their campaign, the question was asked by one of the most uber liberal people on television, Sonny Hostin. So we have a lot more coming your way on the Commute with Carlson. Wait until you hear how the mainstream media have reacted. They reacted immediately after she said it. So Ari had it yesterday afternoon, and it was on some of the cable shows. Now the rest of the media are trying to get rid of it. You know, get that in the rearview mirror as fast as possible. She didn't really say that. You know, but, oh, she did. And by the way, she was being candid. There was a moment of candor there. And clearly, she wasn't prepped, don't know why not, on that question. Maybe they thought, well, it hasn't come up so far. And if they had prepped, she had forgotten what the answer was. But she answered it, frankly, honestly. Your legendary lyric is, again, a hit from the 60s and again in the 80s. But how many heartaches must I stand before I find a love to let me live again? You recognize it? When we play it, going in or coming back from break, be calling number 10, 206-421-5757. We got those nice prizes coming your way. Now we have nice Philip J. Vandervoort III coming your way with a social media sweep.
Yeah, as we're talking about Hurricane Milton this morning, you're going to talk to Cliff Mass coming up to start the 7 o'clock hour.
Yeah.
This is a story that has been percolating this week. I want to give a hat tip to Markley Van Camp and Robbins because I heard this clip on their show a little bit earlier this week, 9 a.m. to noon here on KVI.
You know what? They do some good stuff.
They really do, man. Yeah. Especially if you only listen to one segment of their show, listen when they start at 9 o'clock, yeah. 9:06, because they've always got the tip of the spear of the political world, and they sum everything up really nicely in that first segment.
They play a lot of a cutting-edge audio just fresh from
finding
this morning,
what has just been happening in the last few hours a lot of times. So the social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. And this is an audio clip from Republican U.S. Senator Tom Cotton. Mm-hmm. And he's talking about this FEMA money controversy where Secretary Mayorkas, Department of Homeland Security, said we're going to run out of FEMA money before hurricane season ends. and this has set off a whole tidal wave of controversy that the Biden administration has been using FEMA money to pay for illegal aliens that have crossed into the United States and then are waiting to be adjudicated here. But then there's a lack of money for Hurricane Helene victims, as an example, and now potentially Hurricane Milton victims. So let's play you what happened between Tom Cotton and the host of Meet the Press about where this money does or doesn't go.
Okay. My broader question to you, I think, is about this misinformation. Do you think this is a time to put falsehoods aside, like the idea that FEMA funds are being redirected to migrants, which is just not true?
Well, it is true that FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security have been spending billions of dollars on migrants. Now, I understand some people say they're separate funds, but we just passed a short-term spending bill. It's very common for the administration to come and ask for permission to move money between funds, especially to prepare for emergencies. And second, I would note that this administration seems to have no problem finding money when they want to spend it on their priorities. When they need hundreds of billions of dollars to pay off student loans for graduate students in gender studies programs, they somehow find it. When it's trying to get helicopters to deliver food and water and cellular service and life-saving medicine into these mountain valleys, they somehow can't seem to find the money.
And I bring up this Tom Cotton clip this is an ongoing problem in Washington.
Yes.
And I'll give you a perfect example. Voters in Snohomish County in next month's election, they're going to have to decide on whether or not they want to raise their own sales tax, which is going to impact their cost of living and make it more expensive to live in Snohomish County, to pay for police staffing.
Same thing in Spokane.
Yes, Spokane has one as well.
And my take is, since when did law enforcement and public safety become an add-on?
Right. They've got money to do things like, an example, DEI curriculums and trainings and things like that. But now we have to raise our own taxes to have public safety and policing, which should be one of the two or three priorities of any government agency or level of government. But this is how it goes. And then asked to tax ourselves more for the basics.
Yeah.
But they always seem to find money, like Tom Cotton said, for their pet projects.
This is a growing tendency of government, particularly in blue states, where if you want to feel safe, if you want safe, secure neighborhoods, okay, well, we can give you that threshold of safety, but you're going to have to pay an additional surcharge, an additional tax to cover it. It's not how it's supposed to work. It's 6:31 on The Commute with Carl. Well, we got more bad news for Kamala Harris. Again, if you're just joining us, I played the Q&A. It's less than 20 seconds long. That should end the Kamala Harris campaign for president. She has been very carefully portraying herself, cultivating an image as the candidate of change. And then yesterday, when she was surrounded by friendly interviewers on the TV chat show The View, not being challenged on anything, one of the hosts, Sunny Hostin, just asked her, "Oh, by the way, is there anything that you do different from Joe Biden?" And here is how Kamala responded.
"Well, if anything, would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
And if you don't believe her, will just believe Joe Biden. Now, Kamala will insist,
"Clearly, I am not Joe Biden."
But Joe Biden says,
"I'm in constant contact with her. She's aware we're singing from the same song sheet."
So constantly working with her, singing from the same song sheet, you're hearing the checklist in the background.
She helped pass all the laws that are being employed now.
Okay.
She was a major player in everything we've done, including passage of legislation which we were told we could never pass. And so she's been, and her staff is interlocked with mine in terms of all the things we're doing.
Whoa.
"Clearly, I am not Joe Biden.
But clearly, she can't think of anything she'd do different from Biden. That should end her campaign. Joe Biden's popularity rating is in the high 30s to the low 40s. She has, again, cultivated this image of change. And as I mentioned a few minutes ago, it's actually working. Half of the country thinks that she would bring as much change as Donald Trump. No, if she would bring any change, it's in the direction of even more ruinous policies that have already infuriated people. So Joe Biden not doing Kamala any favors, that was a soundbite from last week. And then Kamala not doing herself any favors when she couldn't think of anything that she'd do different from Biden. Well, yesterday, we played you some competing soundbites from Kamala Harris and Governor DeSantis, a little tempest before the storm rolls through, where allegedly Governor DeSantis is refusing to take her phone calls. And Kamala Harris just excoriated Ron DeSantis for playing politics at a time like this. And Ron DeSantis saying, hey, number one, I don't recall getting a phone call from you, so I don't know what you're referring to. And secondly, by the way, this isn't about you, Kamala. Well, now here is Joe Biden just yesterday praising Governor Ron DeSantis for how well he's working with his administration. Have a listen.
The governor of Florida has been cooperative. He said he's gotten all that he needs. I talked to him again yesterday, and I said, whatever. I said, no, you're doing a great job. It's being all being done well. We thank you for it. And I literally gave my personal phone number to call.
So, so much for the attempt to politicize the hurricane from Team Harris. Politicize the hurricane that just passed. That would be Helene, and the hurricane that's right in front of us, Hurricane Milton. But DeSantis, by the way, is doing an outstanding job. He is one of his underrated and I would say understated advantages, assets, is in addition to being right on many key issues and courageous in pushing for them, even if it meant having a showdown with the Disney Corporation, putting aside politics, he's just very good at managing. He's a very good governor. And no one's going to accuse Joe Biden of being a master administrator, or Kamala Harris, for that matter. She has very little executive experience. Okay. The Commute with Carlson. We have a lot of things going on as we're keeping an eye on that storm, which just could be devastating. We're going to have Cliff Mast from the University of Washington join us in about 15 minutes or so to explain what's happening. Also, what a troubling controversy that Brandi Crews, once again committing great acts of journalism, has uncovered in Gig Harbor. She has found a high school teacher there who has just resigned her office. The teacher in question is a drag performer. Now, it's not a man who is performing as a woman, a drag queen. This is actually a woman performing as a man. I guess you could say a drag king. And being very upfront about this on her social media. And she uses a very vulgar name. We're still going back and forth on whether I can say it on the air or not. I mean, it's not one of the seven dirty words you can't say on television, yeah, but it has a very clear connotation, so I'm not sure we can really say
it. It's the kind of sexual innuendo that probably a seventh or eighth grader would probably use.
And it's caused a huge controversy about the teacher's lack of discretion. And, of course, she goes to the union, and the union says, oh, you're not safe going back to school, which I don't even know. When liberals say it's not safe, I'm not sure what they mean anymore. Unsafe means you might have to hear something that you really don't want to hear, like criticism. But talk about someone who has earned the criticism. We'll have details on that. At 7:34 with Brandy Cruz. Right now, it's coming up here on 6:46. Our legendary lyric contest is underway. This is a hit, a lyric from a hit song in both the 60s and the 80s. I have not clued in either radio legend Mark Christopher or senior chief executive producer Philip J. Vandervoort III on the song yet. But here's the lyric from that song. Morning, Lars.
Thank you, Johnny. And with that kind of introduction, I feel like I can have free reign. Let me ask you something. Have you ever been criticized by the management of KVI for conducting a tough interview?
I have never been criticized by KVI management for conducting a tough interview. Not yet.
You know, obviously CBS has been, you know, the CBS network. They had a biased vice presidential debate.
Oh, yes.
They did a worthy job, I think, of going after Kamala Harris, because I thought that the interview on 60 Minutes revealed she has absolutely no idea what she's talking about and can't handle the simplest questions. But now they're going after one of their own anchors for having done a tough interview. And the tough interview was with this Ta-Nehisi Coates, who's very celebrated left-wing radical writer, author, got lots of awards and all that. And he goes on the show to talk about his new book.
Popular even before Black Lives Matter. Ta-Nehisi Coates had Between the World and Me and a couple of other best-selling books. And then he kind of dropped off the radar and wrote children's books, and then he reappeared, and he's got another book out, which is, some people think, startlingly anti-Semitic.
Oh, well, when he suggests that the state of Israel doesn't have a right to exist, that any country that exists based on the ethnicity of its citizens, well, hold on. I've been to Israel 5 times. They have Arab Muslims who are citizens, run for office, take part in all parts of society. They have Arab Christians who are citizens of Israel and don't want to leave. They don't want to live anywhere else. They've been asked by the Pew Research, you know, hey, would you like to live in Riyadh?
But the bottom line is he was being interviewed on CBS this morning about his book, and he got some very tough but fair and civil questions.
And guess who the network comes down on? Ordinarily, networks pat people on the back if you said you did a good, tough interview. As long as it was tough and not rude, you weren't asking boxers or briefs like some, you know, Bill Clinton was asked by some student years ago. You're not asking, you know, when did you stop beating your wife? Although, you know, who knows? When did you stop beating your girlfriend might be a good question for Kamala Harris's husband, because he's been accused of beating his former girlfriend and impregnating a nanny and a lot of other sleazy stuff. But they come down on Tony DeCoppel. Now, I don't know DeCoppel, but I've been watching the interview, and it's like that's a perfectly appropriate set of questions. And Ta-Nehisi Coates is saying the same thing Jimmy Carter said in his book
a couple of decades ago, that Israel is an apartheid state. And then you say, well, hold on a second. You're a Muslim. There are 50 countries on this planet that are Muslim majority or run under Sharia law and other forms of Muslim law where nobody is equal except Muslims. And then you suggest that Israel doesn't have a right to exist and that it's Jim Crow, and it's his phrase, not mine. He says it's right. Jim Crow.
Look, what he was committing was an act of journalism in a network that increasingly is political and not anchored to good journalism.
Very well said.
And so Tony DeCopel should receive a medal. He should not receive a criticism or condemnation from any of the people at CBS. But CBS, again, just lacks backbone. Of course, we are not the weather station. We don't often talk about weather-related events unless it's really, really unusual and really, really important. And it is in Florida, where they just got hit by a devastating hurricane-turned-tropical storm, Helene, and are about to get socked by what might be, what might become, the strongest hurricane off the Atlantic Ocean ever. It's Hurricane Milton. And we have asked Cliff Mass from the University of Washington Department of Atmospheric Sciences, the same go-to source we talk to about weather and climate-related issues when it comes to, you know, the political ramifications and the ongoing debate. Now we just really want to focus on the weather itself in Florida, at least in the Tampa Bay area and south. And he's kind enough to join us this morning. Check out his great blog post, Cliff Mass, two S's there, cliffmass.blogspot.com. Good morning, Cliff. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine.
Okay. You've been doing the weather for many decades. How unusual is Hurricane Milton?
Well, it's strong, but it's not the strongest ever. We got to be careful there.
Okay.
Right now it's a Category 4 storm. One thing the media hasn't talked about is that although it's very strong, it's very small. So, you know, some storms are much, much larger. You know, Helene was much, much larger. So when you want to think about the damage of a storm, you got to think about not only the central pressure and the strongest winds, but the size. Mm-hmm. And the size of this is modest. So I think that's important. It's an important subtlety the media hasn't picked
up
on.
It is important. I haven't heard that reported. Very good. Yeah. Thank you.
So in any case, it's a Category 4 storm. It has sustained winds of around 155 miles per hour. Now, that's the same winds. The gusts are higher. You know, the gusts are often 30%, 40% stronger than the sustained winds. So, I mean, there'll be places they'll be getting gusts of, you know, 170 miles per hour or so. So, you know, it's strong. And the way it's going in, its biggest problem is going to be the storm surge. It's coming in right near Tampa. So from Tampa southward, the storm is going to push enormous amounts of water up on the coast. We're talking about a storm surge of 10 to 15 feet. On top of that, there'll be waves.
When you say storm surge, you mean the amount of rain pounding down?
No. This is in addition. Forget about the rain. Okay. I mean, the rain will be bad enough. The rain, there'll be places that'll get 10, 15 inches of rain. What happens is there's strong winds associated with the storm. And when the storm is just offshore or right along the coast, south of the storm, the winds from the storm push water up along the coast.
Got it.
So the winds go counterclockwise around a low. So south of the low, the winds will be pushing the water right inland. Okay. So that actually is the most dangerous aspect of a hurricane. It's not the winds. And it's not the rain. It's the storm surge. That is typically the most damaging, devastating aspect. So we expect, you know, from Tampa southward along the coast there, that the storm surge will be huge, and it'll inundate, you know, the whole coastal area. That is That's very dangerous.
Okay, so in the last 24 hours or so, has this storm gotten more or less dangerous?
Well, it's always been dangerous, but it's slightly weaker than it was. I mean, it was up to a Category 5 storm. Now it's a Category 4. So the winds have backed off by around 10 to 15 miles per hour. So that's happened. But it doesn't matter. The storm is going to be very, very strong. And again, the key thing is the size. And if you look at the satellite pictures, you can see it. It is not a big storm. So the damage is going to be limited spatially, but where it affects the coast and inland, it could be pretty bad.
By and large, as you look at the coverage of this issue, are the media doing their job? Are they being responsible, or are they getting this wrong?
No, I think in general things are fine. I mean, the National Hurricane Center is putting out the warnings, mm-hmm. and the media is repeating them pretty well. So there's not a big issue there. I mean, the thing I'm most worried about is the hype about climate change and stuff that some media do.
That was what I was going to ask next. You're hearing.
I suspect some will do.
Well, you've had the Hurricane Helene, and right on top of it now is one of the worst storms ever. Here comes Hurricane Milton. This is climate change, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
And your take on that?
Well, I mean, climate change may be helping a little bit, especially for the very strongest storms. But actually, the number of storms that have hit us, the southeast part of the United States, has not been increasing, interestingly enough. So I think we got to be very careful with that. To me, the policy issue that's most interesting is what happened with Helene, how the forecasts were used to protect people. I mean, the toll for Helene was horrendous. Hundreds and hundreds of people have died.
Yeah.
And it was due to heavy precipitation in the mountains there. That was extremely well predicted, but the proper steps weren't taken to protect people. That's what really worries me. Our forecast ability has gotten immensely better, and society needs to take advantage of it to prevent the deaths. I mean, it's not only hurricanes. What happened in Maui, all the people died of Lahaina. That was another example of a highly predictable weather event. And so society needs to use our forecast better. To me, that's the big issue.
The mayor of Tampa, now this was 48 hours ago, so it was a couple days ago, said if you go to an evacuation center, you're not going to survive. You need to evacuate.
If you don't go to an evacuation center, you might not survive. If you stay where you are, you might not survive.
Well, yeah, let me play it here. This is, again, Jane Castor, mayor of Tampa Bay. Have a listen.
If you choose to stay in one of those evacuation areas, you're going to die.
Wow. I mean, that is an incredibly blunt message. And I know you have a lot of experience dealing with these storms. You don't say something like that lightly, Mayor.
I've never said that.
What she's saying is, an evacuation center would actually give you a false sense of security. She says, just get out.
No, what she's trying to say is that, you have to, in the evacuation areas, not centers, in the evacuation areas, which is along the coast, mm-hmm. she's telling everybody to get out. And that's good advice. She may be, maybe some people survive, who knows. But it is obviously a very bad place to be. If you're near the coast, there could be 10 or 15 feet of water with waves on top of it. That is not survivable if you're right along the coast there. So, unless you're in some tall building or something, then you might be okay. But it's an extraordinarily dangerous situation.
So here's a question you've gotten many times over the years. We have these terrible storms coming off the Atlantic Ocean hitting the Southeast. How come we don't have similar type storms from from the Pacific Ocean hitting the Northwest.
Well, I mean, there's tropical storms that hit the Southeast United States, okay? You know, hurricanes, things like that.
That's what I mean. Yeah.
Right. We never will get them. We can never get them, and that's because of the water temperature. You know, the Gulf of Mexico right now is in the mid 80s. Unbelievable, right? So that water is warm. The water temperatures off our coast are only about 50 degrees. Well, it turns out warm water is the key fuel for these tropical storms, these hurricanes. Mm-hmm. And so Gulf of Mexico, you know, is wonderful. You have to get 78 degrees. That's the magic temperature, 78, 79. We will never have water warm enough to allow us to get tropical storms. So it can never happen. Even the global warming, it will not happen. The water will never be warm enough.
Okay.
So
We have just another minute or so, and I really appreciate you taking the time. Cliff Mass from the University of Washington, my guest. Looking at the storm as it progresses, Milton progresses, when will it be most ferocious? When will it be doing the most damage in your estimation?
It's at the beginning. It's when it's going to weaken. Once it gets over land, the fuel gets cut off. No more warm water. So it's most dangerous on the western side of Florida, where the storm surge is going to occur, but the storm will be most powerful. So the big action that's coming up, it's today. By tomorrow, it'll cross Florida, you know, weak into a weak hurricane, and then go over in the Atlantic. But the whole story is during the next 12 hours is the big story.
So basically, it hits from the Atlantic, hits Florida, and then back into the Atlantic.
Yeah, from the Gulf of Mexico. It's on the Gulf of Mexico right now. So when it's over the Gulf of Mexico and when it just goes inland, that's the big danger, and that's what's today.
Okay, because it hit the Yucatan Peninsula and supposedly had winds of like 175 miles an hour or so.
Right. It just skirted the northern part of the Yucatan. It was stronger then. That's at one point, it has sustained winds of 185 miles per hour.
Wow.
Unbelievable. Now, at that point, it was like the third strongest hurricane ever to occur in the Gulf of Mexico and the tropical Atlantic. So it was unbelievable. It was tight, but it was very, very, very strong. The winds are not as strong now, which is very good.
Cliff Mass, University of Washington, thank you. Great review of everything in front of us there, and we really appreciate you coming on the show, explaining all this to us, Cliff.
Sure. Good talking to you, John.
You got it. That's Cliff Mass, University of Washington. Check out his blog. It's the most popular blog of any UW faculty member. And it's about all things weather. And it really, even if you're not a wonky kind of guy, he says some very interesting things. And then sometimes he will talk about weather-related issues like climate change and like, you know, the Climate Control Act, the Climate Commitment Act, which he's voting yes on Initiative 2117 to strike down the Climate Commitment Act. He thinks it's a bad science. He thinks it was incorrectly, falsely, deceptively marketed and passed. Remember, it was only going to cost pennies. He thinks it is an unfair tax on poor and working class people, redistributing wealth to politically connected organizations and governments, local governments. Anyway, so
you know, John, you bring up a good point too. I mean, Cliff Mass, I mean, the expert.
Really?
He should do the commercials for it. I mean, they got Bill Nye on the other side, the science guy.
What a great idea. What a great idea. Well, they have Bill Nye, the science guy, who's not the science guy. I mean,
he's an engineer.
He understands the rudimentary basics of science. He took his degree in mechanical engineering from the UW. But Cliff Mass is your science guy.
Yeah. Maybe we could have a Cliff Mass, Bill Nye
debate
on I-2117.
Bill Nye would never do it.
I think
he
you're
would,
right.
He would never do it. He would be facing a real, let's put it this way, Cliff Mass will forget more about science, about climate science, than Bill Nye will ever know. It is 18 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVR, Legendary Lyric Contest underway. And the lyric is from a hit song from the 60s and later became a hit song in the 80s as well. Here is your lyric. When you hear us playing it in or out of commercial break, be caller number 10. Some nice prizes coming your way, Marcus.
Yeah, Daniel's brother, always a favorite here. What a time to just enjoy some nice steak dinner here. Take it easy here as we get close to the holiday season. And speaking of that, think of Daniel's brother, me, for a holiday party. They've got some great party rooms. Check out Bellevue, downtown Seattle, Leschi, South Lake Union, the website. That's where you need to go, danielsbroiler.com. Adding to your Reed collection here, since we got time now here, follow the science from the award-winning investigative news reporter and host of ABC TV's Full Measure, our good friend Cheryl Atkinson. Follow the science, how Big Pharma misleads, obscures, and prevails. Available now, by the way, online at your favorite bookstore as well, John.
All right. So I have hidden the song title from both Phil and Mark. Have you guys figured
it out?
That's
true. We did not get an early preview, an off-air preview before the show.
Yeah.
It took me three times of running it through my brain. I did finally figure it out.
You figured it out? You know it?
He's ahead of me.
Okay, here we go.
I'll find it somewhere.
But how many heartaches must I stand before I find a love to let me live again? One more time. But how many heartaches must I stand before I find a love to let me live again? Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Philip J. Vandenbort III standing by. The social media sweep, go.
Going to give you an option here. Do you want Hurricane Milton information or do you want I-2117 information to start the social media sweep?
I want to start with 2117.
Okay. Social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. People are starting to post the latest blog post from Todd Myers at the Washington Policy Center. Mm-hmm. And Washington Policy Center's Todd Myers has been tracking all things environment. And yes, now the issue of 2117, which is on the ballot for voters in Washington here on the November 5th ballot. And his latest blog post about this is he's managed to obtain invoices from British Petroleum, BP, a fossil fuel company. And the blog post is titled Washington's CEO Tax Fossil Fuel Company Admits that gas prices will fall if the Climate Commitment Act, the portion of it that goes to the cap and invest law, is repealed. And so Todd Myers writes, oil giant BP's own invoices show that if the CO2 tax is eliminated, prices at the pump will go down. BP sells fuel on the wholesale market. And after the state's CO2 tax went into effect, the company began showing the cost of that tax on customer invoices. The cost of CCA allowances, that's the Climate Commitment Act, which created this whole cap and invest scenario. The cost of the CCA allowances is listed on the invoice as WA cap at the rack. And the rack relates to the rack price of the fuel or the petroleum product. And he says CCA is also called a cap and trade system, and the rack is the term for wholesale fuel sales. Hence, cap at the rack. So there's an admission that, yeah, if I-2117 passes and the cap and invest law and the carbon auction permit scheme is discontinued, gas prices will fall. And that's from an actual fossil fuel company.
That's not guaranteed at all.
Right? And that's from an actual fossil fuel company in the state.
Which, by the way, for political purpose, craven political purposes, this company's so pathetic, BP, is actually opposed to 2117.
Right.
So
for public relations purposes,
for public
right?
relations yeah. for, and yeah. political purposes uh-huh. inside Olympia.
Yeah.
But the bottom line is, as you point out, even they are admitting, well, yeah, the price will go down. The same guy, Jay Inslee, who said the price of gas would barely go up and might even go down if the Climate Commitment Act were passed, is now saying, oh, there's no way that you can guarantee prices would go down. Of course it would. Again, Jay Inslee lying at both ends.
Yeah. Par for the Inslee course. Someone has posted a graphic from the National Weather Service that lists the top 10 lowest barometric pressure Atlantic hurricane. So we talked about this a couple days ago with Hurricane Milton, which jumped up to a Category 5 storm, and it had this incredibly low barometric pressure reading of 897 millibars. There have only been four others that were lower than that. But the top 10, basically, there was a storm in 1935 that's in the top 10, a storm in 1969, a storm in 1988.
I think that was Hurricane Camille.
69 was Camille, correct. Yeah. 1988 and 1990. There was another one in 1980. So you have 1, 2, 3, 4 storms between 1935 and 1988 that make the top 10. And then you have six others, basically, from 1988 and on that make the top 10 lowest barometric pressure, kind of that top intensity for hurricanes. So there's a bit of a spread. There have been 1, 2, 3, 4 in the last 20 years, though. So we do have four storms in the last 20 years, hurricanes in the Atlantic or the Gulf Coast, that have been amongst the top 10 most intense. So that is something to consider. One note, the passing of Major League Baseball icon Louis Tiant.
Oh, from the Cleveland Indians pitcher.
Age 83, native of Cuba. He pitched 19 seasons, won 20 or more games four different times, won two ERA titles.
Again, with Cleveland.
And I think he's most remembered for having maybe the most unique windup, where he would essentially turn his back to home plate and then uncoil himself to throw to first, throw to home plate. Fernando Valenzuela kind of had a little bit of that going on.
Two wildest windups. And he had Louis Tiant literally turning his back to the batter as he was, you know, had one leg in the air. And the second was Juan Marichal.
Ah, Marichal. Great answer. Yeah.
Who would have his leg kicking over his head.
Yep, to generate that drive to home plate for
incredible windup.
Velocity. And somebody else posted Louis Tiant pitched more shutouts. At 49 shutouts in his career than any other major league player not in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
He's not in the Hall?
Correct, yeah.
You've got to be kidding me. Yeah.
Isn't that strange?
Whoa. That is a surprise. That is very unfortunate. If there's someone who deserves it. Again, he did all this with a terrible baseball team. The Cleveland Indians were... Well, like the Seattle Mariners were in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s and part of the post 2000. We could go on, but you get my drift. Brandi Cruz joining us about a drag king school teacher who has left her job citing cyberbullying. But Brandy has some context and details you're going to want to hear on this coming right up. We're back on the John Carlson Show. We once again thank Cliff Mass from the University of Washington, authority on all things weather and climate, talking us through and taking us through a Hurricane Milton. Now, one of my favorite people in the media, Brandy Cruz is one of my favorite people in the media because she's in the media, but she's also a journalist. And it's amazing to me how many people in the media who hold down journalism positions have forsaken the craft of journalism, but not Brandy Cruz. Good morning, Brandy. How are you?
Good morning from Bellevue. I'm actually with your buddy Ari Hoffman, and we're at a Dave Reichert event this morning, bright and early.
Yes, yes. No, I couldn't make it for obvious reasons. Otherwise, I would be there as well. Dave Reichert doing a series of events, and I think today was the kickoff in Bellevue?
Yeah, he's having a big breakfast, and then I know they're just doing a final push because those ballots are going to be out before we know it.
Yes. No, absolutely. It's good to have... good to have a huge push right before the ballots drop. But what I want to talk to you about has nothing to do with a governor's race, but with something of a scandal slash controversy in the Peninsula School District. That I would point out, the Peninsula School District is where the man I am endorsing for state school superintendent happens to hail from. That's David Olson, who's a school board member there and former president of the board. It involves a faculty member. Her name is Kay Wayne. She chooses to go by they, them pronouns, but that's not why she got in hot water and ended up parting company. Basically, I'm guessing, reading between the lines, was paid to go away by the Peninsula School District, Brandy.
Yeah, this is a wild story because, I mean, you know, you probably the same way. We get a lot of tips from parents. We get a lot of tips from students about things that teachers do that they feel like are inappropriate. Some of them we don't feel like rise to the level of doing a story, but this one was really interesting. And it sparks this, our segment on it has sparked this massive debate. I've now been the subject of hit pieces in the Tacoma News Tribune, Cairo 7 News, The Stranger for covering this. Basically, Kelsey Wayne is the teacher's name, high school teacher, as you said. Moonlights as a drag king, as Kelsey. I actually don't know the biological pronouns, and so, but I'm not going to say they, them, so I've just been saying he.
She is a woman who performs as a man and uses they, them pronouns, so biologically, she's a woman.
Okay, I didn't know that because it wasn't obvious to me. But anyway, the pronoun nonsense just makes all this confusing. But with moonlighting as a drag king, I don't know if I can say actually the name of the drag king. I'm going to give people a warning.
I tell you
can
what,
I, John.
The answer is yes. Just give the three names she goes by. Her title is three names. Just a little space between each one.
Yeah, Jack, King, Goff. Got it? Okay. So we all know what that is supposed to mean. And so the issue for us really wasn't that a teacher would be moonlighting as a drag queen or king, because honestly, I've been to a lot of drag shows, John. Some of them are just like theatrical performances, singing, dancing.
Yeah.
I don't think we would have done a whole segment on a teacher who in their free time was a drag king or queen. Wouldn't have done it.
Right.
It had to do with the vulgar nature of this particular drag persona, the vulgar social media, public social media profiles that were obviously not private enough that students couldn't find them.
Well, the lack of discretion is what hits me. It's not so much what she was doing. It's just her lack of discretion on what she was posting on social media. I mean, she was, as you pointed out, really digging into the world of vulgarity.
Well, and, you know, there were a lot of there were a lot of concerning, you know, he referred to himself, the drag king persona, as, I think I can say this, orgasmic drag king, you know, had been posting things like, lock up your daughters, Jack King Goff is here. And for parents who saw that, they're understandably freaked out, like, lock up your daughters, what are you talking about? And so they had, you know, some community forums and school forums on social media, got wind of this, were posting the pictures. So Kelsey Wayne didn't come back to class for a few days. Then we got the story. We did a segment, and Kelsey Wayne decided, well, I can't possibly face my students again, so I'm just going to have to quit my job, which, fine. Nobody made her quit. She decided to quit because, again, she knew that, and she has since acknowledged in some news stories that I tried to keep my drag life very separate. I knew it could be problematic if it was uncovered by students. And look, it was.
I was going to ask. Did the students know about this?
Yeah, the students know about it.
Okay.
And after it was uncovered by a few, I mean, even before we got involved, you know, this had been circulating on social media among students and parent groups who'd been complaining to the school. And so, you know, the way Kelsey Wayne has since portrayed it is that my segment was sort of the, you know, the final straw where it took it from just being something that would blow over to being something that she felt like she had to quit her job as a teacher because she could no longer teach kids anymore because this would be such a distraction. And my response to that is, well, whose fault is that? Whose fault is that? Seems like you made a really poor judgment decision, knowing this could be a problem. Obviously didn't care enough, and it was a problem. What's been interesting, John, though, is what's happened in the days since our segment.
That's what I want to get to, because I think what you did was, you know, you're pointing out this is someone whose lack of discretion resulted in students knowing about what this teacher was doing off hours. And And you were simply reporting on that controversy. And now people are furious. Some people are furious with you for basically publicizing what was happening.
Well, and it's wild to me because it really shows, I think it shows a few things, that our standards for public school teachers are apparently so in the toilet that we even have to have a debate over whether it's appropriate to have a sexually explicit drag king persona in your free time, right? So after this happened, Kelsey Wayne quits her job. She goes out contacting media outlets to go on some sob tour, painting herself as a victim of right-wing media, you know, whatever, transphobes, and, you know, making it sound like I got her, you know, I cost her her career because I simply don't like, gay people or drag performers, which just isn't at all what it was.
Well, and let me quote, Kelsey Wayne, quote, "I don't want people thinking that the district pushed me out. It was very much like we were in communication with each other, and they wanted to make sure that I was okay, and I wanted to make sure that I was listening to myself." In other words, they came to an arrangement. I'm guessing the district probably wrote a check for her to part company with the Peninsula School District.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so she wasn't run out of town on a rail. She's not a victim, except of her own poor choices, in my view.
Exactly. And so these media outlets, Tacoma News Tribune, Cairo 7 News last night or the night before, The Stranger, you know, they published these stories which were shockingly sympathetic toward Kelsey Wayne to me. And really, the stories made it seem like this was just about Kelsey Wayne doing drag at night.
Yeah.
And you know, really glossing over the whole reason we did this segment in the first place, which was the sexually explicit nature of the posts. And so I was just shocked by it. It really felt like the media was intentionally, they saw this story, you know, she wanted to use them as her personal PR team. They bit because it's really, I mean, they are eager to paint conservatives as like hateful bigots, right? So here they saw, oh, conservative political commentator, you know, runs a transgender teacher out of town for being a drag performer. And that's really the way, if you were a regular news consumer and you watched Cairo 7 News a couple nights ago, you would think I'm like the worst bigoted human being on the planet.
You know, I've got to say this out loud. I've known Deborah Horn for a long time. Deborah and I worked at Cairo TV together when I was doing Point Counterpoint. She was a very young reporter. That was many decades ago, and I've always liked her, but I was really disappointed in the quality of her story.
Well, it was very surface level, but it left out key things. They never said or showed on screen what this drag persona was. They never said or showed on screen the post, and that tells you a lot, right?
Well, that's the whole thing.
It probably was not going to be kosher with the FCC.
The whole thing was how sanitized what she was doing and what she was saying and posting online, not in a private account, online, the things she was posting. Those things were sanitized from most of the media coverage, Brandy.
Well, and that's the whole issue, and that negates the key reason we did it and makes me, and really it's not just about me, because Deborah Horn, if you notice, she didn't even say my name. She just kept saying local conservative, you know, political commentator.
Which was weird.
Posting online videos, which is really weird, but I think it's intentional or not, it's designed to create a larger narrative to the story that this is about conservatives being hateful. That this isn't about, you know, the nuance of this isn't about a specific segment done on a specific teacher who did a specific thing very worthy of criticism. It was about conservatives are hateful people. That's what they wanted to paint it as, and that's what the News Tribune did. That's what the Stranger did. And that's I think, what, to me, the whole takeaway of this is now is they took what is a legitimate criticism. You know, never in any of these stories did any of them push back against Kelsey Wayne and said, hey, you know, do you think that you had poor judgment here? Do you think you showed poor judgment? Do you think you bear some of the responsibility for this?
She herself says that she didn't want students to know about this, and yet students found out about this. Duh!
Yeah, they're high schoolers. They're very good at this stuff. They're very good at sleuthing.
So I thought what you did was very good journalism. I thought that the media coverage of her departure, again, using all sorts of sanitized vocabulary and phraseology and the like. And the person who got it right was you, and the person who was asking the right questions was you, Brandi Crews, because you always do. Before we go, if people want to subscribe to Brandi Crews Undivided, best podcast around, how do they do it?
Thank you, John. Undividedpod.com. You can find a button you can click to subscribe and support our work for $5 a month, because we work for our viewers and listeners, which is awesome.
One more time.
Undividedpod. So undividedpod.com.
Undividedpod.com. Check it out. I'm a subscriber myself at the premium level, or the higher than the introductory level, but you can join $5 a month. It's a great value because Brandi does great journalism. Thanks for joining me. Say hi to Ari, say hi to Dave, and look forward to talking again soon.
Thank you, John. You're missed here this morning, but you got stuff to do.
You got it. Brandi Crews, undividedpod.com. It is 11 minutes to 8 o'clock. The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Still to come, a woman who decided to feed the raccoons and then couldn't get rid of them. And look how many raccoons came to visit her. All that straight ahead as the Commute with Carlson continues, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Radio 570 KVI, right where you need to be. And yes, because it is Wednesday, time for our legendary lyric contest. You know the way it works. We play a lyric from a hit song. And when you hear that lyric going in or out of commercial break, you be the 10th caller, and some nice prizes coming your way.
Oh, you're really goosing it today, John. Okay, Daniel's Broiler, we love it. Seattle's favorite since 1980. USDA Prime Steak, you bet. Don't forget, high-end spirits, fresh seafood, underline fresh seafood on that one here, especially this time of year. Think about holiday gatherings, too. They got room for it. Daniel's Broiler, all four locations. Bellevue there, not far from shopping. Downtown Seattle, good for theater. Fun downtown. Leschi here, over there on the lake here in South Lake Union. Online reservations, dine-in, takeout, delivery, danielsbroiler.com. And for reading here through the fall and winter, how about the new book, Follow the Science, from award-winning investigative news reporter and host of ABC TV's Full Measure and good friend of KVI, Cheryl Atkinson, the book called Follow the Science. And John, a review real quick in a sentence.
Best thing written about the politicization of science by the media. There you go. Anyway, here's your lyric. It is from a hit from the 1960s, which became another hit, another artist in the 1980s. But how many heartaches must I stand before I find a love to let me live again? But how many heartaches must I stand before I find a love to make me live again? When you hear that song going into commercial break or coming back, just be caller number 10. All right. Yesterday was not a good day for Kamala Harris. It was supposed to be a cakewalk. She appeared on the TV chat show The View. And she received an adulatory greeting. Like I said, it's like if Taylor Swift walked into a convention of Swifties, of Taylor Swift fans. Just, they're falling all over her. Okay. Well, she was so well received that she kind of let her guard down a little bit. And one of the hosts, who's the uber liberal Sonny Hostin, asked, you know, is there anything you would do different from Joe Biden? A question that, quite frankly, she should have been asked months ago and still hadn't been asked. Think about that. Not a single member of the media asked Kamala Harris, who is portraying herself as the candidate of change, who says over and over again, I'm not Joe Biden. Nobody had asked, well, what would you have done different from Joe Biden? Until Sonny Hostin did. And this is what happened.
Well, if anything, would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
She wouldn't change a thing. She's the candidate of change, but she wouldn't change a thing from the last 4 years. Oh, Tim Walz, just waking up, heading out of Seattle to do another fundraiser. What do you think of this?
We can't afford 4 more years of this.
Okay, well, that should be the end of the campaign. Because the Harris campaign, the Kamala Harris campaign, has actually been getting some traction on the issue of change. Because, let's face it, in terms of physical appearance, she's very different from Joe Biden. Different gender, different race, different generation. But in terms of the direction that she would take the country, we'd keep moving right in the same direction we've been going. Think of the decisions Joe Biden has made that have contributed to high prices in the stores, high gas prices, an out-of-control border, as Bill Whitaker from CBS 60 Minutes, Bill Whitaker, no conservative by any stretch of the imagination, said the numbers have quadrupled. She wouldn't change a thing. So my good buddy Ari Hoffman was thinking the same thing I was. And this is what he suggested on his show yesterday afternoon.
Would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
That's all they got to do. I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message. This is Kamala. And remember, Joe Biden last week, we've played this clip over and over and over again. Has been saying how, you know, they sing from the same song sheet, that our staffs are interlocked, constantly working together, that she and he are in close touch all the time. They should make that into an ad. People need to know Kamala Harris equals a continuation of the status quo. Okay, a change agent, you know, a candidate who is running to change is going to go in a different direction with different policies that will yield different results. Yesterday, several journalists sat down and talked about that answer that Kamala Harris gave. Here is what Molly Ball from the Wall Street Journal, political writer, not editorialist, political writer, told Dana Bash on CNN.
I've done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years.
There is not a thing that comes to mind.
Molly, what do you make of that?
I'm surprised, frankly, that she doesn't have more to say about this, given that she and her campaign know that this is one of the main questions that voters have about her. And one of the main things she's been trying to establish as part of her candidacy is the idea that she would represent a break from the past 4 years, and to not be able to come up with something to say in that moment. She continues to not be particularly nimble on her feet in a lot of these interviews. And this is a very obvious question that gave her an opportunity, frankly, to differentiate herself in a way that would have made news, that would have answered, I think, the curiosity of a lot of voters who want to know how she would lead differently.
Yeah, the reporter for the New York Times Zolan Cano Youngs, he's their White House correspondent for the New York Times, was similarly flummoxed.
You are framing yourself as a change candidate, but you also represent incumbency. You were a vice president for the past 4 years, and often saying that you were the last one in the room as well when President Biden would make a decision. So it's tough to detach yourself from a president that, you know, consistently in the polls has been unpopular with the public as well.
No kidding. That's why I'm saying they need to use those words against her. And I think it's so delicious. It's so delicious that the question was asked, you know, not by a hostile reporter, not by someone who's seen as being a conservative, but as an uber liberal, New York liberal attorney and host of The View, a co-host of The View, Sonny Hostin. I just love that Sonny Hostin might have helped ice the election for Donald Trump. I mean, that's just delicious. That is just so wonderful to think. But this is how, again, the best kind of ad you can run in politics is when you're criticizing your opponent, use your opponent's own words. Use your opponent's own comments to nail them. You know, she's trying to say, you know, I'm not Joe Biden. And yet, here she is saying, I can't think of anything I do different than Joe Biden. And then you have Joe Biden saying how close they work together, and how we sing from the same song sheet, and how we our staffs are interlocked. Just keep making that point over and over again. You know the less than 30% of the American people think that we're on the right track. That's less than the Democrat base vote. 28% of Americans think we're on the right track. Nearly two-thirds think we're on the wrong track. Well, who's been driving the car on that track for the last 4 years? Who's been driving policy for the last 4 years? Biden and Kamala Harris. So she's not change. She is the status quo. Okay, so that's the first bad news that Kamala Harris got yesterday, basically just stepped in it. Another example of that is just earlier this week, we played you the clip of Kamala Harris criticizing Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, while she was speaking to a reporter on the tarmac outside D.C. at Joint Base Andrews. Ron DeSantis was accused of not taking her phone calls. And when she was asked about it, here's what she said. Again, you got to listen carefully. You hear the jet noise in the background.
Playing political games at this moment in these crisis situations. These are the height of emergency situations. It's just utterly irresponsible.
Playing political games during a time of emergency is just utterly irresponsible, she says.
It is selfish, and it is about political gamesmanship instead of doing the job that you took an oath to do, which is to put the people first.
It is selfish. It is political gamesmanship instead of doing the job you took an oath to do. That was her withering criticism of Governor Ron DeSantis. Here's Joe Biden talking about Governor Ron DeSantis yesterday. So you're going, it happened when President Biden was speaking at what's called a press gaggle. So you hear a lot of reporters asking this, you know, question at one time, and eventually this is the question that comes out, and here's what Biden says about DeSantis.
The governor of Florida has been cooperative. He said he's gotten all that he needs. I talked to him again yesterday. And I said, no, you're doing a great job. It's being all being done well. We thank you for it. And I literally gave my personal phone number to call.
Well, so much for that narrative. It sounds to me like Ron DeSantis is being praised for keeping his eye on the ball, which is exactly what he told reporters who asked him about Kamala Harris. He said, I don't even recall getting a call from Kamala Harris. I don't know what she's referring to, but I will say this, Kamala, it ain't about you. We are trying to deal with what could be one of the worst hurricanes in Florida history. And that's where we are. That's what our focus is right now. And then out of that, you get this.
The governor of Florida has been cooperative. He said he's gotten all that he needs. I talked to him again yesterday, and I said, no, you're doing a great job.
There you go. All right, you got 18 minutes after 8 o'clock, The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI, right where you need to be. By the way, if you haven't heard the news, let's bring it home local for just a moment. Boeing has withdrawn its latest offer to the machinists out on strike. Here's Como's Mary Nam.
Boeing Commercial Airplanes President and CEO Stephanie Pope said after 26 days of the employee strike, the two parties were unable to reach an agreement. She continued to say the strike has, quote, deeply affected Boeing's business, customers, and their community.
And at this point, you know that Boeing is going to start looking for options. This is a company that has offered a huge pay hike and has also offered a huge increase in company contribution to 401ks, a better health plan. The union says, no, we want them to reinstate the defined benefit pension, which they're not going to do and they shouldn't do. They would be financially irresponsible if they did that. So at this point, the machinists turning down what many people I've talked to, union members, people who've worked for Boeing, said is a pretty good offer, especially given the fact that Boeing as a company has not been doing well. They've lost many billions of dollars. So we'll see what happens next. But the last time you had a long, angry, drawn-out labor dispute, Boeing ended up building its 787, its second 787 assembly line in another state. And all those jobs went to South Carolina. Just something for the machinists to think about before they keep pushing this company in the direction they are. Never gone this late on Wednesday without a legendary lyric being played. That means got to be played in the next 15 minutes or so. So stand by your phones. Your lyric is, but how many heartaches must I stand before I find a love to let me live again? When you hear that, be caller number 10 at 206-421-5757. Some nice prizes coming your way. Right now, Philip J. Vannevar III coming your way. The social media sweep, social media from socialists.
The Washington Democrats are bringing some Hollywood firepower to campaign in Washington. And this is all about Initiative 2117. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. The Washington Democrats on their social media handle at Wash Dems posted yesterday, join Jane Fonda and the No on 2117 team for a day of action. Let's hit the streets and knock on doors to spread the word about these harmful measures that threaten our communities. Don't miss this chance. Sign up now. So they're basically inviting people to potentially rub elbows with Jane Fonda in this No on 2117 campaign. And somebody in the comments thread posted, "Oh, please, 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 please let this woman knock on my door."
She's 80, 85, 86?
I'll have to stipulate on that one. I have not been keeping track. But again, how do the Washington State Democrats think this is going to help them with voters who have any connection whatsoever to the military to have Jane Fonda representing their interests?
Well, again, this is what happens when you live in a bubble.
Yeah.
First of all, young people don't know who the hell she
True.
Is.
Yeah, yeah.
And older folks who do are split. There are those who remember her great actress and the aerobics queen of the early 1980s, Jane Fonda's workout book.
Yep.
And there are the veterans who remember clearly that she not only called Vietnam veterans liars and cheaters, she posed with Viet Cong with a an anti-air missile launcher.
Yep.
So here she is posing with a weapon used to shoot down American aircraft for the Viet Cong.
Yep.
That's how far in the tank. She wasn't anti-war. That's the euphemism. She was pro-Viet Cong.
Yep.
There's a difference. And she was on the side of the communists.
There it is. All right. I have a Shama Sawant update. Have you heard that she has been in Michigan and she's campaigning with the Green Party candidate for president, Dr. Jill Stein, and a bunch of Democratic political strategists who are pro Kamala Harris are pointing out what Shama Sawant has been up to. Listen to this clip that was posted of Shama Sawant and making this confession in Michigan that they want to prevent Kamala Harris from winning the electoral college votes from Michigan.
We are not in a position to win the White House. But we do have a real opportunity to win something historic. We could deny Kamala Harris the state of Michigan.
Listen to that applause.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I was supposed to applaud. The first time I've applauded a comment by Shama Sawant.
Right? So.
We like to do for you now a tune entitled Shama Lama Ding Dong. So hit it.
So here it is, Shama Sawant, in cooperation with the Green Party and the candidacy of Dr. Jill Stein, are doing what they can to prevent Kamala Harris from winning Michigan, which it is essentially would be one of the two big states that Donald Trump would need to win the Electoral College and become the next president. So that's what Shama Sawant is up to, and they don't seem to be making any apologies that they're... goal is to give the presidential election to Donald Trump. That's apparently how badly they don't want Kamala Harris to be president. But that's where they're putting their political capital right now with Shama Sawant.
Well, all I can say to Shama Sawant, if you're listening, is I wish you luck. For once, you're helping the country after you ruined a city. So... we'll call it penance, okay? I don't know if you're Catholic. I know you're not Catholic, Shama, but we'll call it penance, all right? You're listening to the radio program of record, The John Carlson Show. When we come back, the lessons that we should learn from the lady in Kitsap County who decided to start feeding raccoons, and now she's so inundated with them, she doesn't feel safe on her own property. What we can learn and how we can apply it to politics. Our winner is Breanne, KVI listener Breanne from Mukilteo. I remember Breanne. Yes, she said that she met me at Linwood Motiplex. It was last summer. We were collecting signatures for the Natural Gas Initiative. That's Initiative 2066, the initiative that the Seattle Times has endorsed. So they do something right over there every so often. How about that? But it's the initiative that will give consumers the power to decide if you want natural gas in your home or business. Not the government. The government will no longer be allowed to restrict your access to natural gas. How about that? So congratulations, Brianne. Now, about this song. It is, of course, You Can't Hurry Love. And we played the Phil Collins version. It came out in 1983, top 10 hit.
We all thought it was strange playing this song. Like, Phil Collins doing Motown?
Phil Collins wanted to see if he could. He didn't want to do his own interpretation. He wanted to do a remake and see if he could bring back the spirit of 60s music.
Yeah.
So here's a Brit and a drummer at that. Doing a Diana Ross and the Supremes classic.
Yeah. You remember, that was a thing of the 80s. Just do a 60s version and you'll be fine. Yeah, there's your Supremes.
Well, and the Supremes took it to number one.
Right.
Now, it's interesting. It was a number one hit and a top 10 hit for Diana Ross in the UK. So it was number one in America, top 10 hit in Great Britain. Yeah. For Phil Collins, it was the opposite.
Yeah.
It was a number one hit in Great Britain and a top 10 hit in the United States.
Yeah.
So, yes, that is a classic Motown sound from Diana Ross and the Supremes. Yeah. 1966, yeah. Summer of 66, that it came out.
A couple things just real quick. Everybody brags about Phil Collins being the young kid in the audience for Hard Day's Night with the Beatles. He was also in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. He was one of the kids there. There's one point. I confirmed. You can see him. He sees the car for the first time. He's about 16 years of age at the time. Then he was part of all the kids when they stormed the castle, the Bulgarian kids. But they cut that scene because he had an eye patch, and the director says, you look a little too much of a threat.
Too threatening there with one eye.
So there you go. His acting fun.
Okay, so I said earlier that there's one political contest, a very pivotal one, one that has national symbolic significance. That we don't have to wait for Election Day. This race is over. George Gascon was the most famous of the George Soros prosecutors. He had been the chief prosecutor, Kamala Harris's old job, in San Francisco, where he was famous for not trying criminals. And then he heads down to L.A., and in 2021, actually it was 2020, elected during the Black Lives Matter aftermath, he promises that he's going to go easy on criminal charges because it's unfair to people of color. Well, he got his way, and as a result, a massive increase in violent crime, the disproportionate victims of which, of course, are people of color, specifically black people. Civil disorder, neighborhoods, and entire areas of L.A. were no-go zones. So the very people who need the most help that he said he was going to be fighting for, advocating for, were the ultimate victims of his policies. But that's the political left for you. They will use race to get power, but then they will push ideological agendas, extreme agendas, that make us all less safe and make criminals much more secure and happy. I don't like happy criminals. I like when criminals aren't happy. Anyway, he's running for re-election. And former federal prosecutor Nathan Hochman is running against him. Hochman is ahead of Gascon by 30 percentage points. Again, Gascon is the incumbent running on his record. The latest LA Times poll, actually it was the University of California Berkeley poll taken for the New York Times, shows Gascon with 21% of the vote. Hochman has over 51%. and everybody else is undecided. Not only that, but Hochman's role, his lead, is actually 5 percentage points higher than it was 2 months ago. Same poll. So he's actually gaining momentum, and Gascon is circling the drain. Gascon, the most famous of the soft-on-crime progressive prosecutors. You have Krasner in Philadelphia, Kim Fox in Chicago. She's gone now. Chesa Boudin in San Francisco. Thank God he's gone. He got fired. He got recalled by the voters. But Gascon, elected with massive contributions from high-tech millionaire Reid Hoffman and left-wing billionaire George Soros, basically wrecked L.A. Of those who support Hochman, 96% say it's important to prosecute violent crime. Another 90% say there's too much turmoil in the DA's office there. So there you have it. That's the first race of 2020 that we can call with certainty. The most left-wing prosecutor in America, who basically got the job as prosecutor so he could not prosecute cases. He got the jobs so he could avoid prosecuting people. That's what the left has done. That's why they get these prosecutors in there. Instead of helping accused criminals one at a time, they simply wall off prosecuting entire areas of crime. And that's what made Portland like it looks like today. It's what made Seattle the basket case it became. It's digging out, but it's going to take years. That's what made San Francisco a basket case. And L.A. too. But it looks like L.A. finally got the memo. So good for them. Democrat voters. Okay. Now to my favorite local story of the day. It has resonance for all of us. A very nice lady decided to start feeding the raccoons a long time ago, like 30, 40 years ago. Now they are overrunning her property. Very nice lady. Every neighborhood's got one. She loves to feed the pigeons. She loves to feed the birds. She loves to feed the wildlife. And one lady took it way too far and ended up feeling endangered on her own property. Was overrun now with the raccoons because she kept feeding them. Here's Como Force Jackie Kent.
This almost looks like a zoo.
By now, just about everyone in the colorful city has heard about the so-called raccoon invasion of a woman's property.
So 35 years ago, you first started.
This video, captured by the responding Kitsap County Sheriff's deputies, almost seems unreal.
I've certainly never seen anything like this. None of the deputies have ever seen anything like this. This was new for everybody.
The woman said she's been feeding raccoons in the area for almost 4 decades. But last week, she was surrounded by the animals reportedly being aggressive and begging for food. So she called law enforcement for help.
What?
I got to tell you, if you see the video of this, there's like 50 or more raccoons just swarming all over her property. And they're not leaving. They're just hanging out.
It looks like it could be a creepy...
waiting to get fed. Where's Stephen King?
Horror-type movie. Yeah, Stephen, yeah, very, yeah. Good example. Yeah.
Here we go.
Our raccoons are not safe to toy with. People shouldn't get near them. They certainly shouldn't feed them. And obviously, word got out in raccoon land, so a lot of them are showing up because they expect that they're going to get a meal.
Other longtime Polesbo residents tell us it's common to see the masked mammals on their own properties near wooded areas and even sent us their photos of the animals.
Okay. So she realized when she was out feeding, once again, dozens of them, And then they started snapping at her. And then they started getting feisty. And then they started getting aggressive. And she felt unsafe. So she ended up calling the police. Help me, help me. She made this problem. And you heard what they said. They said, well, when the word got out in Raccoon Land, they all started showing up. And when they started showing up, they showed up expecting to be fed. And when they weren't getting fed, well, they started getting aggressive.
40 years of feeding raccoons. What were you thinking?
When you look at her, well, we had this problem in our neighborhood. A very nice lady, not there anymore, but she just said, oh, we love the raccoon. We love wildlife. And, it's, you know, there's all these, but there we had less than a dozen raccoons.
And a dozen's a lot.
And a dozen is a lot. And it was at the other end of the neighborhood, so it wasn't bothering us so much. But anyway, same phenomenon. But here's my point. This is how government deals with the homeless. This is how government deals with feeding poor people who are just hanging around.
Yeah, same magnet effect.
And am I comparing human beings to raccoons? No. I'm comparing the instinct to get something for free. Yeah. And when you don't get it and you expect it, you get ticked off and you start misbehaving.
Yeah, it's good cause point. And effect.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Do you not see a parallel here? And would you rather hang out and wait for someone to feed you, or do you want to go out and forage for it and earn your meal? Again, there are real lessons here that should be applied to how you deal with street vagrancy, with the homeless, etc. There should always be an expectation that you don't get anything entirely for free, or you end up like this poor lady.